Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
The horse was discovered and had this piece of rope on the bridle, and that rope assumed some significance because the family immediately commented that it wasn't their rope.
Kirsa Jensen is a name burnt into the memory of many New Zealanders. On September 1st, 1983, Kirsa collected her horse from the paddock next to her home near Napier, then rode him to the beach at Awatoto, but she never came back. Her body was never found. No one has ever been charged. This is Crimes NZ, and I'm Jesse Mulligan. In this episode, we hear from Detective Inspector Ian Holyoake, who headed the inquiry into Kirsa's disappearance.
I don't know, the memory's always there.
Yeah, and it was such a famous case in New Zealand, wasn't it? Even for people who didn't live in Hawke's Bay, everyone knew that name, Kirsa Jensen.
Yes, there are. You know, I guess New Zealand had a proud record of being a country with very few homicides, very few murders. You know, there's only ever one a week, roughly. and pretty much everyone is solved. And that's because the offender is still standing there with a smoking gun or a bloody knife or hammer or axe. But occasionally there's a mystery. And this was one of those. And I guess, yeah, stuck in memories, it's got a lot of human interest because the missing person was a 14-year-old girl, and everyone knows a 14-year-old girl.
So what do we know about what did happen on that day in September 1983?
Well, she just went for what was a normal sort of ride after school. She lived with her parents. Her father was a vicar at a local church, and she had a horse paddock next to the church and manse, and she got a horse and rode off down a green belt sort of out to the sea, which would only have been, about 2 or 3 kilometres away, and rode along the beach, which I think was a common practice for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she would do that, you know, sometime after 3, and should have been back again, I think, by, 5:30 something. Certainly by 6 o'clock, her mother was quite worried and began looking for her.
And what was the last sighting of her?
The sightings at the beach were around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which would be not long after she got there, and sort of seemed to span, I suppose, the most known ones, around 4:15 to 4:45 of her riding on the beach alone with the horse, and then pulled up at a gun emplacement and seen there sort of 2 or 3 different lots of people, and then just completely she vanished. But the horse, later when people started looking, when the police were called, and sometime after 6 o'clock or about 6 or something, the horse was discovered. And it's evident that it had been tied to the gun emplacement by a piece of rope, but it had broken away from the gun emplacement and had this piece of rope on the bridle, and half of the rope, just a small length of rope, was still on the gun emplacement. And that rope assumed some significance because the family immediately commented that it wasn't their rope, it was a strange rope. And that became really the only clue that there was in the whole case, was a piece of rope.
Yeah. And what about of those sightings, what was the most interesting?
Oh, well, the sightings at one particular person described to us, he claimed to have been driving across the nearby bridge, which is probably a couple of hundred metres from the gun emplacement. And this is, we're talking along what was then State Highway number 2. motoring past and looked across to the gun emplacement, like 100, 200 metres away, and saw the girl with a horse talking to a man who had a white truck. And for some reason, he thought that was suspicious. For the life of me, I can't see what was suspicious about it, but it so aroused his concern that he decided to go in there and see. But that wasn't an ordinary feat. He actually had to drive another couple of kilometres along the main highway, then turn off, double back along a back road, then come out and cross the highway again and go over to the gun emplacement, which would have taken, you know, 5 minutes, I think. It would have been 3 or 4 kilometres. And when he got out to the beach, the girl was there with a horse and the man with the white truck had gone. She had a bit of blood on her face. She'd had a fall, and she said a man had been there, and he'd gone to get her parents. So this witness said, okay, well, I'll leave it to it, and he drove away, carried on with what his work was. And we then spent the next several weeks trying to find this man in white truck, and in the end determined that the man in the truck didn't exist. It was made up by this alleged witness, and we began to feel there was more to his connection with the girl than what he had revealed to us.
So who was the witness?
His name was John Russell, and he lived halfway between Napier and Hastings, I guess you could say, and he worked on an orchard. I can't remember why he was driving over towards Hastings on that day. He was not unknown to the police, and some suspicion did attach to him because of that. And because of the strange story about he thinking there was something suspicious and going to investigate. And then when we just couldn't find the person and we couldn't find the missing girl, we began to re-examine Russell's story. And the scientists offered to subject the piece of rope to a very special scientific examination. And they determined there were 42, as I recall, 42 different minerals, pollens and spores in this rope. And they said if they ever found the place where this rope came from, they would definitely know that. And we puzzled over this for some time. In fact, we began all the trucks that came within the gambit, and we're still looking for that. We were checking them and checking ropes and checking for minerals and pollens and spores. It all turned to nothing. And in the end, we went to the house of this witness, and by collecting pollens and spores from the area where he lived, the vehicle that he drove in, and the orchard where he worked, we were able to determine the 42 pollens and spores were associated with him and that rope and his car and his home and his work. And and so that made us really think that he had used his rope from the boot of his car, and it was a rope we discovered. He was supposed to have part of a caravan awning that the boss that he, you know, person that he worked for had asked him to dispose of, a caravan awning. He had, as you perhaps naturally would, he kept two or three ropes, so awning ropes were quite a good piece of rope, and I'm quite convinced he had one on the boot of his car, and he tied the horse up with it. And what he did with the girl, though, where she went, I don't know.
Yeah. Meanwhile, while all this is going on, of course, the nation is transfixed. The case is on the front page of the local paper for at least a month.
Yes.
And the police and media were working together to try and encourage anyone to come forward.
Oh, certainly, yes. There was great support from the media. There were then local papers in Napier, the Daily Telegraph and the Herald Tribune in Hastings, and I remembered the editor of the local Napier paper coming to see me after a week saying, look, Ian, he said, we've had the story on the front page for a whole week. I don't think as much as everyone's interested we'll be able to keep it there. Well, we kept coming up with the little tidbits every day and new leads and things, and it actually stayed on the front page for 4 weeks. So there was a lot of interest. And then we created our own, we created a video we made reconstructing what had happened and played that in shop windows in town. And, I mean, it as I said at the start, it was a real human interest story, and it appealed to everybody, and everyone was keen to help.
Got some audio from 1983. This is from our team at Ngā Taonga Sound Archives. And this is Curse's parents, Robin and Dan, each pleading for her return. Here's Robin Jensen.
If anyone hears Curse, I just ask you, please bring her home. Bring her home safely to us as soon as you possibly can, and we'll forgive all. All we want is our darling daughter home again.
Yeah, and Dan, her husband.
Please come forward and tell them, and I'm sure, I know that they will be heard gratefully and sympathetically, because I know that the way the dealings that we've had with those searching for her have been just so great, and we're so thankful for every effort that's been made so far.
Do you think your daughter is still alive?
Well, we haven't had any news to the contrary, and we have the faith to believe that life is stronger than death.
Amazing cut from Dan Jensen, the father. As you say, it was a bit of a goose chase trying to track down that white truck, although there was another sighting from another witness involving a white vehicle, Ian.
Once you mention a thing like that in any case, then people think they've seen one, and you pursue all these leads, and then you find the one that person saw and determine it had no connection at all. So you go back looking for the rest of them, and so it just goes on and on. I still to this day think it was a wild goose chase, and we were wasting our time.
Okay. So at this point, though, when the forensic evidence seems to suggest so strongly that this first witness, John Russell, is connected to the case, you must have felt as though you had your man.
Oh, well, there was certainly evidence pointed towards him, but there was nothing. There was not enough to go to court. I mean, we asked him about it, and he said, no, he didn't do anything like that. And he couldn't explain away the rope bit, but that was the only thing that pointed at him. And he just maintained his innocence. And, you know, people in the area where he lived, friends and family, neighbours, we'd checked out, you know, immediately when we heard his story. When did he get home? But the people tended to support that he got home, and so we took his story at face value for a while, and that was misleading.
So he actually basically confirmed that the rope was his. Was a rope that he had in his possession?
Yes, when we put it to him that we could prove scientifically, he did agree that yes, it must have been a rope that he had in the back of the car, and yes, he must have loaned it to the girl to tie up the horse, and he'd forgotten all about it, and it was just. He's getting the story to fit, or his explanation to fit the story, and altering around as necessary.
But you didn't have enough evidence to go to court. In fact, here you are, Ian, talking to media some months after the inquiry about the continuing efforts to find evidence.
We're looking at areas of search. In fact, I looked at one area yesterday, and I'm talking about search of land and search of waterways, and don't want to be any more specific than that. The scientific evidence, as I've said, is quite intricate and detailed, and we're to be quite honest, we're dealing in areas of pollens and spores and minerals, objects which to even see requires magnification of several hundred times, and so you can appreciate from that it's a very detailed analysis that the scientists have been doing for us. We have set out, as I've said before, to try and determine where that rope came from. And to that end, the rope itself has been a key exhibit and subject probably to more scientific testing than any other exhibit in any other criminal case in New Zealand, I'd venture to suggest.
So that's our guest today, Ian Holyoake, Detective Inspector Ian Holyoake, talking about the search for evidence. We also have you announcing to reporters that there is not enough evidence and the case is not strong enough to take to court.
We were optimistic throughout the investigation that we would solve it. That optimism is perhaps based on a number of factors. Firstly, the police inevitably do solve such investigations, and that's evidenced by the four or five murders or attempted murders there have been since the disappearance of Kirsten Jensen. As well, one has to have a positive mental attitude in an investigation of this type. We had a good team working on the inquiry and tremendous public response. That and perhaps perhaps a little vainly believing in my own experience in previous cases, I was optimistic we would solve the case. However, that has not occurred, not so far anyway.
Can you tell us what are the missing links in this chain that you speak of that are preventing you instituting proceedings?
No, I can't really.
Well, where does your evidence fall down then? Where does it fall short?
Well, it's difficult to deal in evidence. That's something that I don't want to discuss. We've carried out the investigation as best we can. We've collected as much evidence as we can. And as we've said in the statement, that there is insufficient on which to institute any criminal proceedings. And I can't take it any further than that.
Must have been a hard news conference to deliver, Ian.
Yes, I guess that's towards the end of the weeks and weeks and months of investigation, and with the interest beginning to wane and the clues disappearing and very few leads, I must have tried to make a final go-away conference. But the hardest thing really was to go and see the parents and tell them, which I would have done just prior to that media release. And I'd said to them right at the start that we'll find your daughter, I promise you that. Yeah. And I went to them months and months later and said, I'm sorry, I failed.
Tough on you personally?
Oh, yes, most certainly. In fact, I had a 14-year-old daughter myself at that time, and they shared some classes at the same school.
Boy. And in all these years, you've never found, or nobody's ever found, a body or indeed any suggestion of what might have happened to her?
No, not at all. Different leads come in. In fact, by a strange coincidence that I'm still looking into, I actually got an email 30 minutes ago from some person I've never heard of offering me some information. I've yet to make contact with them. Things like that have happened to me over the years. Over 37 years, but in the current police officers, there's always someone monitoring this case, and leads come in and they're looked into. Often they're silly and fanciful things, and for goodness sake, thinking of something 30 years later and so on, I thought I should tell you that is not a heck of a helpful. But you appreciate the information. It might be that someone has been harbouring something all this time, and that they might come forward. Remote though it seems, one always hopes for that, and even now I still do. And I still think about the case. I occasionally speak to Robin Jensen when she's passing through Napier. She'll perhaps call and speak to my wife and I, and the father, Dan Jensen, he's called here and seen me too. And a few months ago, I had a meeting myself and one of the other officers who's worked closely on this case during my career and after I retired. He and I had a meeting with the local detectives and updated on a number of features on this case and things that were being looked at and reviewed.
What was the nature of the email you got half an hour ago?
Oh, just a person that's come up through Facebook. I thought I should tell you. This happened at the time of Kirsten Jensen, and I think you were involved with that case. But then he didn't tell me anything, so I'm not quite sure there's some half of the message that I can't see. And I couldn't follow it up then because I was waiting for a call from your studio. So,
okay.
I've had lots of things like that, and I get my hopes up.
We'll stay in contact with you about that one. So how about this guy, John Russell? What happened to him? Did he ever admit that he'd had something to do with her disappearance?
Not really. His mental ability deteriorated over the years. I transferred away about 18 months after this disappearance to to Wellington, to police headquarters, and then later to, again to Christchurch. But he occasionally was inside mental institutions, and indeed on one occasion he came to me in Christchurch. He walked out of the Sunnyside and came down to the police station where I was the district commander then, and he came in and saw me and wanted to discuss the case and wondered if he really had done it, and perhaps I did. No, I don't think I did. Maybe I've done it and I've forgotten. You know, his mind was just wandering, and he would sort of half pie admit something, and then he would deny it again. And so he even went, one occasion he went to the television studios at Avalon and wanted to make a confession there to, I think it might have been, funnily enough, the late Genevieve Westcott, who passed away just in recent weeks. I've talked to her in recent times. She hunted me out when she came to Napier here in the last year, and we talked. He went to see her. He went to see other media people. And then finally, he took his own life and never left a clue. So if he did harbour the secret, he took it to the grave.
You think he did it, though?
I can't say. I'm... you know, really governed by the evidence, and there wasn't sufficient evidence to take him to court. And I've got to be convinced of that, as any police officer does before you go to court. So you can think the person did it, but you've got to have enough evidence to proceed, and we didn't.
Did he have a criminal history?
Yes, he was not unknown to the police, but I don't recall the great details of it now, and I wouldn't go into it anyway.
Okay. And there's a memorial at the last place she was seen alive now.
Yes, the family planted the Pahutukawa tree there, and it suffered a bit in the weather over the years. I mean, I was away from Napier for 15 years, and I came back here 21 years ago. And the Rotary Club that I then belonged to, and a part of a community project, there's a Rotary pathway wanders around Hawke's Bay and went past this memorial, and they decided in deference to Kirsta Jensen and to myself, I guess, and they planted some more Pahutukawa trees, and there was a plaque that the family had put there, and so our club's kept an eye on it. One Rotary Club built a shelter there recently, and there's a seat there, and there's the plaque, and I sometimes happen by there and stop and tidy it up and keep it neat.
And then you'll occasionally go into the St Paul's Cathedral or Knox Cathedral and mark her death.
Oh, I actually do. I think the first time when I was down in Wellington, a couple of years later, the 1st of September came around, and I walked from police headquarters down the road to St Paul Cathedral and sat there for a moment. And then the next year I was in Christchurch, and I went to the Christchurch Cathedral and sat there. Well, that's a sorry state now, I see. But then I was in Knox Cathedral a couple of years after that, or 5 years. Not that I'm a greatly religious man. I don't wear my religion on my shoulder, but I did, in deference to the family and their beliefs, I'd spend some time in a church on the 1st of September. And now that I'm back in the Bay, I go out to Awatoto, sometimes with some of my detective friends, and we sit there for a bit and tell stories, some of which are vaguely true.
Thanks for listening to Crimes NZ. I'm Jesse Mulligan. You can catch more of me every afternoon on RNZ National around 101 FM in New Zealand, or listen to the show live at rnz.co.nz. If you're looking for your next history fix, you might like to listen to Untold Pacific History, Eyewitness, or Black Sheep. All of our podcasts are on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.